getting permission.
Enhanced interrogation was okay. We had specific techniques that were approved by the Justice Department.
Seeing how the Bush administration gave itself permission to go beyond simple interrogation of 9/11 detainees is itself a painful exercise. The logic of the so-called torture memos. Tortured logic on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, April 17th. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, a look at those memos. Also, we'll try to get a handle on the housing situation and look at President Obama's ambitious new plan to build a high-speed passenger rail system in different regions around the country. Those stories coming up. First headlines, money and economics. That was expected to be the chief topic of conversation at the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad and Tobago today, but now it looks like the conversation may center around a country that's not even invited, Cuba. President Obama made a call to improve relations yesterday.
It's very much in our interest to see whether Cuba is also ready to change. We don't expect them to change overnight. That would be unrealistic, but we do expect that Cuba will send signals that they're interested in liberalizing.
First signal came within hours. Cuban President Raul Castro said he's willing to discuss everything, including human rights and political prisoners. Here in the U.S., the Justice Department has released memos detailing harsh interrogation techniques used by the CIA under the Bush administration, the most comprehensive public accounting of the interrogation program so far. But President Obama says CIA officials are unlikely to be prosecuted based on what was released yesterday. Richard Hake, what else is going on?
Well, John, some major layoffs announced in the technology sector today. Toshiba says it will cut 3,900 employees in Japan. That's on top of the 4,500 temporary workers it's already dropped. Meanwhile, mobile phone company Sony Ericsson is going to cut another 2,000 jobs. Nearly 30 international donors pledged $5 billion to Pakistan today at a conference in Tokyo. Richard Holbrooke is the U.S. special envoy to the region.
The United States has pledged $1 billion now, and we will get more later for economic development, and that's in addition to other aid. Will it be enough? No. Pakistan needs more.
Japan pledged $1 billion as well. Pakistan is hoping for $6 billion in all.
Some good earnings reports out this morning. General Electric first quarter earnings fell 36%, but it's good news because it's better than many analysts expected. And Citigroup pulled in a better than expected loss, almost $1 billion as well. From consumers from companies to consumers, the consumer sentiment survey is expected out this morning. 500 households are questioned. Analysts expect good news. The S&P begins trading this morning at 865. So everybody remembers that one teacher, that one booster, that cheerleader moment that sent you on your way to success. Who is it for you, Richard?
What school?
Think of an affirming moment that worked or didn't work.
This is Paul from Plymouth, Mass. I have an example where the affirmation went the other way. Seventh grade, I was always a very good writer, and my English teacher wrote in my yearbook, "Paul, become the author you were meant to be. No more waste." That wiped me out. That has given me such a writer's block. I know the teacher meant well. She meant to affirm me. It just went the other way.
Affirmations for kids just starting out. We're going to talk about the science of that in a moment. Your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You are listening to The Takeaway. And coming up on the program, we're going to look at a very interesting study that suggests that if some students are given the opportunity to write about their values, affirm what it is that's important to them just before they take a test, they do significantly better on the test and then throughout their middle school careers. That and more. And, you know, we want to know if there is an affirmation in your life that you can recall that was significant for you in your academic career at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. But we begin with the economy once again. We try to put voices behind the numbers. Yesterday, we got a couple of numbers in the housing industry. New construction tumbling almost 11%. Foreclosures up 2%. But there are demands, or there are signs that demand in the housing market that is so troubled is actually improving in some parts of the country. But to get behind the numbers, we're joined by two people who are very much focused on this industry. In the studio with me, Behrouz Shahidi is a New Jersey realtor who you may recognize from a profile we did on him about a month ago. Thanks for joining us, Behrouz.
Thank you for having me.
And Michael Corkery is housing reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us on the line. Michael, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
So, Behrouz, let's just begin, first of all. If I was at a closing today, how would it be different than, say, a year ago?
I think the dominant feeling would be anxiety.
Anxiety.
Because in the past, let's say 2 years ago, you go to a closing,
right.
You have certain expectations. At times you get surprised by the mortgage person or the attorney or detail of the transaction. But these days, even if you're certain, you're still insecure.
Really?
You are there. You don't know if you're doing the right thing, if the bottom has appeared in the market, if this is a good deal or not, because your cousin says, you know, if you wait 2 more months, you get a better deal.
Hmm.
So...
So there's the anxiety.
The anxiety is the prevalence,
which is the specific sort of mechanism of buyers tiptoeing very tentatively back into this market, which is how this housing recovery is going to take place. Michael Corkery, how is that tentativeness and anxiety, you think, reflected in the numbers that we're seeing across the nation?
Sure. Yeah. It's certainly the market remains very weak, but there are, as you mentioned, some signs of hope, even in the top line numbers. In particular, this week, the number of single family houses that were started for construction, while still at a very low level, it doesn't appear to be in a free fall any longer. In March, it sort of held steady for the third straight month. Now that's very good news because at least in the new home market, it does appear that starts, which is a key metric, is bottoming. So that's one good thing.
Can we talk about that for just a second?
Sure.
It seems to me that at the end of the bubble, just before things burst, new home construction was pretty much disconnected from the buyers in the sense that developers were kind of commodifying houses, just building new ones and just trying increasing the supply with an assumption that they'd all be saleable. Now it seems as though the new home construction is much more tied to a specific transaction. True or false?
Yeah, I think that's very true. There certainly was just a wild amount of speculative building during the housing boom, and that the air has come way out of that bubble. And you're right. Most builders won't start a home unless they've got a sale. Now most of the homes being started and most of the sales in the new home market are to first time home buyers who can get a mortgage that are available, can take advantage of the low rates. So also what's different now is the homes that are being started, unlike during the boom, are pretty modest houses, unlike the big McMansions that were prevalent during the housing bubble.
Well, Behrouz, you know, a lot of these programs are targeted at first-time homebuyers. The New York Times had a great piece about a week and a half ago about a single mom and her daughter were suddenly able to get a house because of all these programs, and they had never thought that would ever be possible, combination of price, combination of programs. Are you seeing that sort of thing where suddenly, for some people, this is like a whole new doorway that they can suddenly walk through?
Definitely, yes. Most of my showing these days are to that group. First-time home buyers. So you're absolutely right. Many who were not in the picture now are in the picture and looking.
So what's that like? I mean, describe, introduce me to somebody. You don't have to use their name or anything.
Yeah, of course. I have many right now. Again, the anxiety that I shared with you is a dominant component of their psyche these days. But the possibilities are there, and they know that they can get a mortgage. They can get like a nice FHA for almost nothing down, like 3%, and at times with all the other bonuses and add-ons, you can almost get to a house for nothing.
Right.
So that's great. So that's a new development because we didn't have it before. on the lending side of it is a little bit tighter than before, but overall, I think it's a new arena in the real estate.
So on the converse side of the question then, who that you would normally see in the market calling you up, looking for listings, that's suddenly not in the picture anymore? The kind of personality, I mean, maybe you'd call them a speculator, I don't know, but give me an idea of who's not in the picture anymore.
All the ones who were doing like stated income loans and were easily qualified before to get a house. I had many clients who were in that category.
So these would be the people who have the bridge loan to justify the bridge loan for the down payment for the bridge loan for the... I see.
Yeah, all the
none
ones
of that,
that
shenanigans
were,
anyway.
No, none of that. But because all the ones who were qualified and probably that type of lending contributed to our current situation to an extent, they are not there anymore because nobody can give them a loan. Hence, they can't afford being in that market. They have to show what they are making.
Right.
And there are many who are in that category and can get
not,
a very nice FHA getting in with ease, I would say.
They can dream, but not in the way that it was before, when you could finance much more of a house than you could actually really afford. Michael Corkery, how is price affecting this downturn or the indications that maybe demand is starting to return? Are there price falls that suddenly bring people into the market that you've noticed around the country?
Yeah, certainly. That's a huge driver, as your guest is talking about, especially for the first time home buyers. You know, the affordability has almost historic levels.
What's an example? I mean, just tantalize me with something that I could get.
Sure. I mean, if you were shopping for a home, let's say in a hard hit market like the Inland Empire of California, sort of Southern California, sort of east of Los Angeles, where there was a lot of houses that were put up and a lot of speculation. I mean, you could get deals of houses that had been priced for $400,000 are now selling for $200,000, and those deals are plentiful. So that is actually in some areas like the Inland Empire of California. I mean, there are bidding wars for these type of discounted houses, and many of them are in foreclosure or in some form of foreclosure, and people are lining up to bid. There's cash, that people are coming with cash to buy them. So there, if you go to a place like that, it's in some ways almost like the old days. But it's a very small segment of the market, and I think that one of the concerns is how many first-time homebuyers are there out there to buy houses? And once that supply of them is gone, what's going to happen to the market? Are we just going to go back to the old doldrums?
Well, quickly, but I'm going to give you the chance to respond to this question before we go, and I'll give Behrouz the last word here. Does this rationalize the market in some way? Even with all of the pain, are we back to a situation where values are rational and demand is actually measurable in a real way?
I think it does. I think that while credit is mortgage credit is still very tight, and almost maybe a little bit too tight, some would say. You got to be able to afford the house to buy it. That's a good thing.
Michael Corkery is the housing reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Behrouz taking on that thought right there, and we just have less than a minute. What's better about your job? You're not making as much money, and there is
definitely
pain, but what's
not
better about your job in all of this kind of rationalization and downsizing?
I would say the rationality of it is the best that is occurring right now, because before it was getting to be unreal. I would show homes to people that I knew they wouldn't be able to afford it, and they had the perception that they can.
It's nice selling houses right here on planet Earth.
Yes. Right now, we are basically back to normal, it's a refreshing feeling.
Behrouz Shahidi sells homes on planet Earth in the state of New Jersey. He was in the studio. Thanks so much, Behrouz.
Thank you.
Asking, are we there yet? Voices looking for a bottom in the troubled housing market. Here on The Takeaway. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's almost a cliche, the celebrity award acceptance speech, but they can always, it seems, recall a moment in time where there was some sort of act of affirmation, some teacher, something that happened in school that sent them on their way to success. Teacher did something that gave them a confidence boost. They describe it in hindsight as crucial to their success. Maybe you can think of one in your own life. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But what if there was a specific trigger for confidence? Well, a study that's just been published in the journal Science tantalizingly shows that the act of encouraging young Black children to write about their own value systems, the things that are important to them at home, can make a big and lasting difference on their future success. Scientifically speaking, is this some kind of confidence trigger? Well, here to talk about it is Valerie Purdy Vaughns, a principal investigator in this two-year study of middle school students, and she's also an assistant professor of psychology at Columbia University. Valerie Purdy Vaughns, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
You know, I have to say, this study is a real fascinating example of taking a domain that's really quite emotional and sort of mushy and scientifically boiling it down to a really tantalizing bit of input and output. Describe the study and what you concluded.
So this study was with 7th, 8th, and 9th graders. Right. Most of the time we target 7th graders. It is a randomized double-blind experiment.
Right. So it's high quality.
High quality. Yeah. The teachers don't know who is in the study. The students don't know whether they're in the treatment or the control condition. The crux of the study is that we ask students in the treatment condition to write about values that are important to them. Friends and family, art, music, creativity. But what's really important is that it's crucially timed right before a test.
So kids are going to take a big test.
Yes.
And you say in the study, all right, just before you do this test, write something that's really important about what happens in your family.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And the science behind it is that there is stress associated with negative stereotypes. And we specifically target African Americans. So while everyone in the class is engaging in right. these writing exercises, there is an added pressure, a pressure of being associated with a negative stereotype. And that's the stereotype of being not particularly intelligent. That adds an extra anxiety in that moment. And so what if you can temporarily relieve that stress by focusing on something, not the test itself, but something else, your friends, your family, creativity, humor, and that
That's what the writing exercise
is.
You've got a couple of examples, and I want to talk about the result in a moment, but let's hear the examples of what you ask kids to do.
I do. So this is from one African-American seventh grader, and she writes, "Relationships with my friends and family are important to me because my friends are just like my family. We're close, and we do things together. A sense of humor is important to me because you gotta laugh sometimes. I also think family and friends are important because everyone likes money, fame, happiness, but they mean nothing if you don't have loved ones to share it with."
So it's not Nobel Prizes for Literature we're looking for. It's heartfelt confidence in the language.
Exactly. It's also in that moment of sort of tapping into your sense of self-worth, shoring up what we call your self-integrity, that I can be successful. And this, I just want to point out that this is very distinct from self-esteem, because you can have high self-esteem or you can have low self-esteem. That's not necessarily connected to the heat of a negative stereotype
right.
that you can't perform because of your race or how other people view your race.
Okay,
in that
so
situation.
Kids wrote these essays, expressed the sort of heartfelt sense of this is important to me. How did they do on the tests?
So they actually perform. So what happens is we find that African-American students, we're able to reduce or attenuate the achievement gap. So African-American students perform significantly better on that test. They also, over time, over the course of the two years of the study, longitudinally perform better to the point that they perform about half a grade point higher by the end of their tenure in middle school. And some people say, well, this is not really a large effect. But when you think about how important your tests are at the end of eighth grade in predicting the kinds of activities and grades and so forth that you're going to get in high school, this becomes very significant and important. It sets them on a different trajectory.
It's described in the report as an upward spiral.
Yes.
Explain how that works.
What we mean by an upward spiral is that performance tends to feed on performance. So if early in the beginning of the year a minority student performs poorly, then the teacher starts to see them differently, and then they start to perform worse and worse and worse in a spiraling downward performance. So what we mean by upward performance is if at one point in time you start to perform better on a test, you start to see yourself differently. Your teachers see you differently. Your peers see you differently. And this leads to future better performance.
So a cumulative chain of success events, starting with the essay, continuing with the test, and continuing with every other thing that happens academically.
Absolutely. And we think this is important because this is not just about the student in a chamber by themselves, that they're really interacting in the environment, the school environment. So teachers may see them a little differently. Their peers may see them a little bit differently. They may feel a little more open and engaged in school. So it is sort of just our intervention is really just a catalyst. It's not the be-all or end-all, but it is what we think a very key catalyst that sets students on a different trajectory.
Do you think this goes directly to changes that teachers can make in classrooms, say, as early as next year?
I think that this intervention needs to be thought about with caution. This is only one school district. This is a fairly well-off school district in Connecticut. They have fairly adequate resources. I think that more work needs to be done in more urban environments. Having said that, I do think that there is a strong potential to make students feel known early in the semester, give them opportunities in school to affirm themselves, but uniquely minority students in stressful test-taking situations.
Very interesting study coming from the journal Science, co-investigated by my guest, Valerie Purdy Vaughns, who is a Columbia University assistant professor in the Department of Psychology. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for giving us so much to think about. And Richard Hake has the headlines.
And John, Cuban leader Raul Castro says he's ready to talk with the U.S. about anything. That includes human rights, freedom of the press, and political prisoners. Speaking from a summit in Venezuela, Castro said, quote, "We could be wrong. We could admit it. We're human beings." Here in the States, New York Governor David Patterson is pushing to legalize same-sex marriage. He introduced a bill in favor of gay marriage yesterday, saying he will leverage personal relationships to get the bill passed. The vote is expected to be tight. The Somali pirate who held an American captain hostage will be put on trial in New York. The U.S. had been considering having him tried in Kenya. Three other Somali pirates holding Captain Richard Phillips were killed during the rescue. Captain Phillips returns to his hometown in Vermont later today. And no thanks, that's what J.P. Morgan Chase is saying to the federal government's toxic asset plan. The bank says it doesn't need to take part and called TARP loans a scarlet letter.
No, it just means they can't give themselves big bonuses.
That's right.
There you go.
Meanwhile, Citibank posted a small first quarter loss this morning. The earnings report was better than expected. Citibank has been one of the weakest of the big banks, posting losses since the end of 2007.
Losses going down. Big bonuses in the future for them as well. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, I mean, was that something to think about there? So you write about something that's really important to your home life just before you take a test, and boom, your score goes up. So your grades. Well, you got us thinking, affirmations. Do you remember one teacher or one conversation back in school that helped lead to your success? We all know words that can have an impact that last a lifetime, and we want to hear what moments and conversations that worked for you and maybe didn't work.
This is Michael. I grew up on Long Island. I wanted to thank Paul Flaum, who was the vice principal of my high school, and told me that, you know what, nobody's going to like you if you're always right. Make sure you let people come to their own conclusions, even if they have to be wrong along the way. And I've taken a lot from that. So thank you, Paul Flaum.
Good advice and affirmations. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You know what I'd really like to do is take a 500-mile-per-hour train from New York to Los Angeles. No can do? Well, at least I can dream, right?
Building a new system of high-speed rail in America will be faster, cheaper, and easier than building more freeways or adding to an already overburdened aviation system. And everybody stands to benefit.
That's President Obama speaking this week at a White House press conference on transportation. Is he dreaming or is he actually starting something that could be built in America? Matt Dellinger joins us. He's a writer for The New Yorker, The New York Times. He is in Memphis, Tennessee this morning. Matt, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John.
So if I were, you know, a visitor to planet Earth and I came upon a construction site and the sign said, future site of high-speed rail system, what would I have to see to know that it's for real? What kinds of things would have to be built for a bullet train in the United States that you just don't see in rail systems elsewhere in the country, like the Amtrak system from New York to Washington?
Well, I first want to say that when Obama says high-speed rail, in some cases he actually means the Amtrak system updated slightly.
Really?
To be faster. I mean, I think what we're looking at here for this plan in certain cases will be the way that the Northeast Corridor became the Acela line, which was a little bit faster. We're talking about incremental change. If you were to see a bullet train construction site, it would be built up off of the earth. It would, you know, to make sure that no animals crossed it, no nothing crossed it. There would be no kind of swinging gates at road crossings. There would be no road crossings. So, you know, a true bullet train is something that we have never seen in this country.
And there's no indication that Barack Obama's interest, at least in standing up and talking at a news conference, in this high-speed rail system is going to ever get us there, right?
Well, it might. You know, it's telling that the U.S. government defines high-speed rail as 110 miles an hour. And some of these trains now go 200 miles an hour, and they're developing trains that go 300 miles an hour.
These are trains in Japan and France and elsewhere.
Exactly, Spain. And, you know, I think what Obama is doing here, and the document they released is called A Vision for High-Speed Rail in America. And one of the main points that he stressed yesterday was that he wanted to create a pipeline. And that's actually something that has been missing. I mean, there's in different regions around the country, high-speed rail advocates have been drawing up plans and imagining things and advocating and lobbying, and there's just really been no mechanism. Our spending on high-speed rail has been in the millions, not in the billions. And so this really is a huge uptick for high-speed rail. Whether it's actually going to create a bullet train from New York to L.A. it's probably not.
Well, what are the endpoints that would be the natural beginning to test something like this for its viability? Would it be New York-Atlanta? Would it be L.A.-San Francisco?
Well, they've got, you know, they came up with a kind of national high-speed rail corridor system idea over the past 10 years or so, or 20 years. And, you know, high-speed rail, there's a kind of a sweet spot. If you're traveling between two fairly major cities that are 100 to 600 miles apart, that's when you want to use rail. So if you're going New York to L.A., it's always going to be easier to fly and more economical. But if you're going from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, or if you're going from Chicago to Minneapolis, those are the distances that high-speed rail is really meant to, or, you know, is best at covering.
Right. Well, you know, the cynic in me suggests that based on some of your skepticism here, even though you do describe this as an enormous uptick, that, you know, this may end up like the, you know, George W. Bush mission to Mars, which we all remember so well.
Right.
And, of course, the hydrogen car. I drive one. I don't know about you, Matt. You know, what do you think the chances are that it's going to end up like that?
I think it's good. I mean, I study highways a lot, and, you know, it wasn't as if Eisenhower snapped his fingers and the interstates were built the next 2 years.
Good point.
The plans for the interstate system were more or less drawn up in 1944 under FDR, something called the Interregional Highway Commission. And it took a dozen years for Congress to sort of summon the political will and the wherewithal to actually finance that plan. So, you know, this is a beginning. It's a humble beginning despite the fanfare. But there is quite a bit we can do to speed up our rail system. And I think in the early going, what they're doing is they're targeting things like rail bottlenecks and grade crossings that might need, you know, a bridge for the road or the rail, just to make things incrementally faster. Even the Acela line, you know, it averages, I think, 80 miles an hour over its whole length. It goes 150 miles an hour for one stretch, but on another stretch it goes 30 miles an hour. So,
is there something that's trivial now that wasn't before?
the railroad lobby. I mean, you know, we've heard of the highway lobby. There's been quietly a railroad lobby. And I think if you're out there and you're a firm that does environmental studies for large infrastructure projects, or you're an HNTB or one of these huge engineering firms, I think you're going to start playing with rail ideas instead of, or as much as highway ideas. And in fact, in Texas, I know there's some of the people who are standing up and cheering for roads 10 years ago are now standing up and cheering for rail.
So suddenly not trivial, the rail lobby.
Not trivial at all.
All right. Matt Dellinger writes for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. He's our infrastructure evaluator. Today he joined us from Memphis. Thanks, Matt. And headlines now from Richard Hake.
And John, the Justice Department released memos detailing harsh interrogation techniques used by the CIA under the Bush administration. But President Obama says CIA officials probably won't be prosecuted. The documents were released after a bitter debate within the Obama administration between the Justice Department and the CIA. In Mexico, President Obama said the U.S. will crack down on drug cartels and weapons smuggling, but he will not try to renew the U.S. assault weapons ban. Instead, he wants to step up enforcement.
We have to crack down on drug use in our cities and towns. We have to stem the southbound flow of guns and cash.
The U.S. is already sending money and manpower to Mexico to help fight the powerful drug cartels. There are a couple major layoffs announced in the technology sector today. Toshiba said it will cut 3,900 employees in Japan. That's on top of the 4,500 temporary workers it already dropped. Toshiba is facing its biggest net loss ever. Also, the mobile phone company Sony Ericsson is going to cut another 2,000 jobs, again because of slogging sales. And these layoffs come just a day after Nokia said its profits fell 90% in the first quarter. Also, from companies to consumers, keep your eye out this morning for the Consumer Confidence Report. Analysts expect some good news from that.
People are going to be feeling confident.
I guess so.
More confident. Less unconfident.
Less
unconfident, right. But not like a Citibank billion-dollar loss.
No.
Thanks, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So what do historians make of the fine print of history? I got to ask that this morning. You know, bits of pottery carefully dug from the scattered rubble of the past, an archaeology of misshapen memos taken from their time, extracted from the events which they described or motivated long ago. What am I talking about? Well, it's as archaeologists that we can approach the memos released from the CIA yesterday. The archaeologist's shovel in this case was the Freedom of Information Act. For years, maybe if you've seen the story, even as pictures, accounts of prisoners, and members of Congress accused the Bush administration of torturing detainees, the administration line was basically, no, we don't. And besides, we got permission to do anything we did. Oh, right, and there may have been a few mistakes. Why not just listen to Vice President Dick Cheney making the case himself?
It's entirely possible there was a problem in terms of how one specific prisoner was handled. I can't claim perfection, but what I can say is that in terms of what the policies of the administration were, both at the White House level and in the Defense Department, was that enhanced interrogation was okay. We had specific techniques that were approved by the Justice Department, but that we don't torture, and that we would not support torture from a standpoint of policy. That was not the policy of this administration.
Approval. Listen to what he said. It is this permission part which is the most fascinating. Basically, by saying that the administration received permission to carry out its enhanced interrogation techniques, a euphemism, by the way, that's historic and legendary in its own right, by saying it got permission, it means there must have been, inside the government, a recorded process whereby techniques were described, evaluated, and then in some way signed off on, waved through with some bureaucratic approval. And it is the details of this permission process that was released in the memos yesterday. Sleep deprivation, nudity, dietary manipulation, abdominal slaps, attention grasps of the head and face, facial slaps, facial holds, confinement with insects, and the famous waterboarding technique. These and more are all listed, described, and evaluated. Herewith, the results in brief. Sleep deprivation, quote, does not involve severe physical pain. I did not know that. Nudity and dietary manipulation, the report suggests, might involve humiliation or significant weight loss, but that being deprived of clothing or food does not produce pain. Weight loss maybe, which the report suggests might actually be a welcome, if involuntary, consequence for some detainees, but no pain. Abdominal slaps, grasps, facial slaps, and holds, it turns out, don't wince now, involve no pain or minor pain, but no suffering. At worst, the pain is, quote, not difficult to endure, in the words of a Justice Department lawyer. Finally, waterboarding, while causing someone to believe he or she is drowning once the technique stops, the report notes, no severe mental pain or suffering would have been inflicted, which is kind of like saying, hey, dude, you didn't drown. Cool. All of the techniques listed, all of them approved. No pain, no suffering. And if there were any pain, it's not difficult to endure, the lawyers say. What would historians thousands of years from now think these memos were? Were they instructions? A rationale for something? Possibly some notes from a bizarre massage parlor or spa somewhere? All we're left with is the fine print.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Take a moment and remind yourself of just what you're good at, what's important to you. That affirmation could be critical in what you then go on to do, take a test, whatever. We've been getting affirmations from you. My sociological teacher at City College, Marlis Kruger, returned an assignment with the comment, "You're good, but you could be better." It was worth so much more to me than the compliments I was accustomed to receiving from my professors, according to Sharon, who emailed us on our website. 8778-MY-TAKE, with your affirmation stories, or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up from Santo Domingo to the major leagues, but first, headlines from Richard Hake.
And John, President Obama is on his way to the Americas Summit in Trinidad and Tobago today. He says the gathering offers the opportunity of a new beginning in the region. Yesterday, he made a brief stop in Mexico, where he says he supported the country's crackdown on drug trafficking. However, the president says he's unlikely to ask Congress to reimpose a ban from the Clinton era on assault-style weapons. Mexican leaders have been pushing for the ban to stop the flow of arms to Mexican drug traffickers. The first Iraq war insurgent to be prosecuted in the United States has been sentenced to 25 years in prison. The insurgent is a Dutch citizen born in Iraq who returned to his hometown after the U.S. invasion. He videotaped himself with roadside bombs that he buried in the sand. But the actual time the defendant will serve is up to the Netherlands. The U.S. agreed to send him back as part of an extradition agreement. A Swedish court has found four men behind the file-sharing site Pirate Bay guilty of copyright infringement. It's one of the world's biggest. The men have each been sentenced to a year in prison and will have to pay $3.6 million $1 million in damages. Despite the ruling, the defendants have vowed to continue running the site through networks located outside of Sweden.
I guess that means they'll take their iPods to prison. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
Bit of news here. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton shook hands with the Dominican baseball star Sammy Sosa during her visit to the Dominican Republic yesterday. Check out this stat. About 10% of all Major League Baseball players in the U.S. are like, and Canada, are like Sammy Sosa. They come from the Dominican Republic.
I got it.
Fly ball.
Fly ball.
Line drive.
So how those Dominican players make it to the big league is the subject of a new film, which you just heard there. The film is called Sugar. In the studio with me now are co-writers and co-directors of the film, Ryan Fleck and Anna Bowden. First of all, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning.
This film is a fictional account of how a baseball player makes it from the very organized training camps in the Dominican Republic to the even more organized training camps in the minor leagues in the United States. And realize or not, their dreams. It's a fascinating pathway to success that Sammy Sosa certainly went on, but he's by no means the majority. How did you choose the characters you decided to focus on?
Well, it came out of a lot of research. We live here in New York, in Brooklyn, and we went up to the Bronx, where there's a huge Dominican population, and we went to this field where these guys play games on weekends just for fun. And we talked to them. We got their stories, and so many of them had been through a very similar journey similar to the one we deal with in the movie. And we heard their stories, and really, the movie is a combination of all of their stories.
Why do you think the story is not so much about crushed dreams as it is about dreams sort of held and protected, almost like those beautiful little tchotchkes you have on your dresser at home? For all of the pain that some of these men go through, they really hold to their dreams, whether they make it to the majors or not.
Yeah, our movie is interested in a character who has one idea of what he wants his entire life. He wants to be a Major League Baseball player in the United States, not just a successful baseball player in the Dominican Republic, but all these young boys' dreams is to come here to play. And if things don't go right, and if they don't quite make those dreams happen, then how do they redefine what their idea of the American dream is? And that's a little bit of what this film deals with.
Why not do it as a documentary? Some people have compared this to Hoop Dreams. I actually think the Hoop Dreams basketball documentary, it couldn't be more different than this story in some ways. But why did you choose not to do it as a documentary?
We wanted to be able to look at the quiet, silent, private moments of character, of things that people go through, the kind of moments you can't capture when there's a video crew in the room. Mm. And we felt like the best way to do that was creating a fictional story, creating a story that was that reflective of a common experience, though. And there have been documentaries that have dealt with similar subject matters.
Well, here's one of the moments that's, I think, typical of the kinds of things you're trying to profile in this film.
A lot of the ball players have stayed at our house. We've had Dominicans and Venezuelan boys, a Colombian, and even one from Panama.
Last year we had a boy, Junior Sanchez. Nice boy. Decent glove, but he couldn't bunt to save his life.
2 out of 12 in sacrifice situations.
Yeah, he cost us at least 2 victories.
Oh, Earl, that's generous. I'd say 4 or 5.
Now, that scene there is where your main character goes in Iowa when he actually makes it to the minors, and he stays with a local family. Is that based on reality, that there are families who take in players and are really, really involved in this whole minor league, are you going to make it to the big show or not kind of drama?
Yeah, that was something we learned again in research in Iowa this time, going to all these small towns all around the Midwest, and there are host families. These are families that take in players, usually the foreign-born players, who are sending a significant amount of their biweekly paycheck, you know, back home. And, you know, the families ease their financial burdens, you know, and they provide them with food and a place to live. And they really care about the kids on some level, but I think they care about their team winning just as much.
Well, you know, this is a place where the script, I think, does something that's really quite amazing. I mean, you listen to that, and you watch it, and you see the smiling faces of Americans and the sort of family atmosphere for the Dominican players. But then you blink, and all of a sudden it sounds creepily like a cattle farm, and these guys are livestock, and these are just sort of farmers. How do you walk that line between the sort of exploitation story and the pure heroic maybe he'll make it story, Anna?
Well, I think that we focus on our character and his journey and what he's going through, and I think that there is an element of exploitation going on around him that you can't ignore, and that just, you know, becomes part of the context of the story and the subtext of what he's going through. And, you know, he's been living in this kind of system that you mentioned. It could be considered like a cattle farm or a factory of baseball players. Mm-hmm. And he's been part of the system for a long time and hasn't really questioned it. But there's a certain point in the movie where he really starts reflecting not only on his own internal self and who he is and what he should be, but also on his place within this system and this world. And so it's more than just a personal awakening. There is a hint of a political awakening.
Now, this film constitutes a certain kind of sort of minor league training camp for actors in the Dominican Republic. You cast almost all first-time actors?
Yeah.
How did you recruit? And were they disappointed that you weren't actually a baseball team when you showed up and said, would you like to come to the United States and be in a movie?
They were playing baseball. We'd go all over the Dominican Republic. We'd drive around and we'd go to a baseball field, break out a video camera, and invite these guys to step away from their game for a few minutes and be interviewed for a movie. And usually they were pretty confused about mm-hmm. what we were up to, because that's not something that typically happens down there. So I don't think they suspected we were with a baseball team, but they weren't sure what we were up to. And we went through quite a few people before we found Al Hines, our star.
Well, the film is called Sugar, a great story of Dominican baseball players who actually make it to the majors and the adjustment that has to happen to their goals between the Dominican Republic and New York. My guests, Ryan Fleck and Anna Bowden, are co-writers and co-directors of the film Sugar, which opens today. Thanks so much for being here. Now, you can learn more about the movie, re-listen to the interview by going to our website, thetakeaway.org. You can also see video of me at the New York Auto Show, in these historic times, trying to figure out what cars taxpayers actually own. Turns out GM and Chrysler maybe aren't owned by us, but you can find out on our website. And you can also talk about our affirmation segment. You can podcast the interview that we did with the Columbia psychology professor talking about the critical role that affirmations before academic challenges actually makes. Here's your takeaway.
There is a strong potential to make students feel known early in the semester, give them opportunities in school to affirm themselves, but uniquely minority students in stressful test-taking situations.
And that, of course, was our guest, Valerie Purdy Vaughn's assistant professor at Columbia University. She got you all sharing your stories of affirmations.
My name is Philip, and I'm calling to pay homage to a teacher I had who I met in a special school for emotionally disturbed children. Her name was Susan Starrett, and I honor her memory because she got me to live outside of my head and more in the real world, and because of her, I have devoted the rest of my life to helping people with disabilities to live full, complete, and independent lives.
Thanks for sharing, and we mean it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Armed and dangerous.
This war is being waged with guns purchased not here, but in the United States. More than 90% of the guns recovered in Mexico come from the United States, many from gun shops that line our shared border. So we have responsibilities as well. We have to do our part.
The Second Amendment to the Constitution seems to be as much of a protection for Mexican drug cartels as it is for law-abiding gun owners in the U.S., the right to bear arms and sell them to drug lords. A boom in exports produces bang-bang south of the border. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, April 17th. I'm John Huckenberry. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about the torture memos released yesterday by the Justice Department and look ahead to the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad and Tobago. And we'll talk to Columbia Professor Sudhir Venkatesh in the final installment of our Color of Money series, Race and the Recession. Those stories coming up. First headlines. Time to move on is what President Obama says regarding interrogation techniques that were used early this decade by the CIA. The Justice Department released memos yesterday detailing them. But President Obama says CIA officials are unlikely to be prosecuted. And it's made some human rights officials angry, like Tom Parker of Amnesty International.
Bottom line here is you've had crimes committed. These are criminal acts. Torture is illegal under American law. It's illegal under international law. America has an obligation to prosecute the individuals who carry out these kind of acts. It's quite simple. That's not seeking to lay blame. That's justice.
The CIA officially opposed the decision to make the memos public, along with many officials from the Bush administration. Richard Hake, what else is going on?
John, President Obama arrives in Trinidad and Tobago today for that two-day regional conference. The focus is expected to be on Cuba, the only state in the area to be excluded from the meetings. The president made a call to improve relations yesterday.
I'm optimistic that progress can be made if there is a spirit that is looking forward rather than backward.
Cuba's President Raul Castro responded just hours later. He says Cuba's ready to discuss everything with the U.S., including human rights, freedom of the press, and political prisoners. It's the most conciliatory language used by Cuba since relations with the U.S. broke off in 1961.
That is big. The bank Citigroup has had its best quarter since late 2007. That's the good news. The bad news is they reported a loss of $966 million after paying off big dividends to stockholders. But before that, the bank had net income of $1.6 billion. Major layoffs announced in the technology sector today. Toshiba says it will cut 3,900 employees in Japan. Sony Ericsson will cut another 2,000 jobs. Consumer sentiment survey expected later out later this hour. Analysts expect good news. Feeling confident, Richard?
Sentimental.
Well, the Dow rose 1.2% yesterday to close at 81.25. The S&P starts trading today at 865. What was crucial to your success?
This is Abigail. I live in Nutley, New Jersey. As a young child, when I went to a Catholic parochial grammar school, Sister Mary Agnes was a great influence. She always advised us to be the best person we could be and to try our hardest. My children are now in the Nutley school system, and it's so sad how the 7th and 8th graders are doing so bad, and there's no one to encourage them.
Encourage us with your story at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Human rights advocates believe they make for very depressing reading, that the CIA is depressed they were even released at all. Two major events relating to torture and the Obama administration and the previous Bush administration. The president absolved the CIA from prosecution for harsh tactics with the interrogations of terror suspects during the Bush administration. And the White House released four memos detailing the directives from the Bush administration, the so-called torture memos. They actually come from the Justice Department. And joining us to talk about the release, the bureaucratic process described meticulously in the memos, and the consequences of apparently absolving the CIA from any prosecution is Jane Mayer, New Yorker writer and author of The Dark Side, which comes out in paperback next month. Jane, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
Let's climb inside the mind of an investigator here. How did investigators like yourself know for sure that these memos existed based on how the news leaked out of what was going on in some of these detention locations?
Well, one of the most important points that's kind of been lost in all this, when you know, everyone says the CIA did not want these memos out. In fact, there have been people inside our government, inside the CIA, inside the FBI, inside the Justice Department, and even in a couple of people in the Bush White House, who, when they saw what was going on in this program, said, basically, this is illegal, this is not American, I don't want any part in it, and they talked to reporters. And eventually, a number of these memos leaked out. The original torture memo came out right after Abu Ghraib. And these are the first memos that where we've been able to really examine the CIA's program in particular, though.
Now, it's coded in language that I hope you'll help us to understand, but it seems that basically what's going on here is when the administration says it got approval from the Justice Department, that's a signal to investigators that there's got to be a set of documents somewhere that describes the alleged torture techniques and then evaluates them and presumably says they're not torture. And is that what's been released here?
Exactly. What these memos do is they make legal acts that were criminal prior to these memos.
Is this reverse engineering? In other words, is this the kind of thing where I got permission only after I got in trouble, Mommy?
Well, good question. I think we've got to know more, and there are plenty of questions still to find out. I mean, in particular, one of the big memos here is written about one detainee, Abu Zubaydah, and the memo is dated in August of 2002, which is several months after they already had and reportedly were interrogating Zubaydah in very cruel ways. So it may be after the fact, in which case it's kind of a cover-up memo to some extent.
Exactly. Let's get into the language. I was surprised to learn that facial slaps are, in fact, not painful.
Well, you know, there was even one of the lawyers in the Justice Department who subjected himself to a number of these techniques, including waterboarding, to see if he could figure out if it was torture or not. And what you're looking at here is a bureaucratization of cruelty. It is this very sort of, you know, kind of question of how many angels can dance on the head of the pin. What's pain? What's severe pain? It's a very weird combination of something that seems very modern and other things that seem medieval.
Although the Sean Hannitys of the world, and I evoke the SH man often on this program, would say no. In fact, this, in the language, shows how tender and caring the Bush administration actually was. What nation would do something like this unless they cared about people?
Well, I mean, what you can see is that there are doctors all over this program and scientists. There are many scientists from the CIA's science division that seem to be involved in this program. And sure, that's one way to look at it. And then another way to look at it, if you really know much about torture in the world, is doctors are almost always present in torture because they are able to walk the fine line between hurting someone and killing them. They know where to stop. And that's why they've got they're monitoring KSM's oxygen levels while they are waterboarding him.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that's the acronym you're using there. What do you think the consequence is for the Obama administration apparently deciding not to prosecute CIA officials?
Well, I mean, I think, again, they are also trying to do a balancing act here. They realized that it would be politically toxic to prosecute people who were given permission by the Justice Department to do these things. And it's politically, as you say, controversial even to hold these things up to the light of day at this point. I don't think it's the end of it if that's what people are thinking, not legally and not politically. I think every time we see another document, it begs for more information.
Perhaps the biggest headline here is that this is another example of the Holder era at Justice, in the sense that he's climbed out from underneath the Ted Stevens prosecution, getting him exonerated in a sense. Has climbed away, you know, has aggressively pursued a prosecution in the Department of Interior, now is definitely moving away by releasing these memos from this sort of torture era. What do you think this says about Eric Holder, the Attorney General?
Well, I mean, I would like to focus on, for the moment, the positive side of this is this was a very hard thing to do. Our government has done something almost no government around the world has done. It has published for the world to see some documents that are so self-incriminating, so disgraceful, because they really think it's the right thing to have this transparency. So, I mean, I would focus on that for the moment. They've said that they're not definitely not going to prosecute people who who followed these orders at the CIA. They've said nothing about the people who gave these orders.
Right. Jane Mayer, thanks so much. New Yorker writer and author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. It's out in paperback in May. She was talking about the torture memos, the approval memos that actually describe and give deliberate approval from the Justice Department for so-called enhanced interrogation of detainees by the Bush administration. Joining us now is Andres Martinez. He's the director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Fellows Program for the New America Foundation to talk about the other big story. Barack Obama, of course, is not in the United States. He's down at the America's Summit in Trinidad and Tobago, a summit of leaders in the Western Hemisphere. Andres Martinez, let's talk about the meeting yesterday between Felipe Calderon of Mexico and Barack Obama. It seems as though the agenda between these two countries has radically transformed in just 12 months. It was unlike any other Mexican-American presidential meeting that I can recall.
I think that's right. I think Mexicans are shocked and pleasantly surprised that an American president is coming to Mexico City and taking responsibility in many ways, or at least shared responsibility, for the increasing drug-related violence in Mexico. There's sort of a honored tradition in Mexico of having American presidents come down and sort of lecturing Mexicans, you know, finger-wagging. And Obama's narrative of shared responsibility, and we understand that this wouldn't be happening but for American consumer demand for drug use, you know, is playing very well.
And he talked also about the guns, the availability of guns coming down across the border,
right,
and the drug violence on the border. Let's talk about the Trinidad and Tobago meeting that happens today. How is that summit likely to be different from other leaders' gatherings in this hemisphere?
Well, I think there's a tremendous, you know, curiosity about Obama throughout Latin America and a lot of goodwill towards him. In terms of dealing with the rest of the hemisphere, Obama has to juggle this kind of promise of a new era with the fact that when it comes to Cuba, which many people see as sort of the canary in the gold mine in terms of evaluating sort of U.S. intentions in the region, you know, on the scale of partner to bully, there's a lot of continuity in terms of the Obama and the Bush approach. So there's some, you know, potential for disappointment there. But I think, you know, Latin American leaders are eager to have a new partner in Washington, and they're going to see how that plays out. But so far, the Obama administration is, you know, fairly status quo on Cuba, despite these, you know, this minor tinkering with the tightening of the embargo that that occur under the Bush administration.
But there's a takeaway. I mean, certainly Barack Obama is not getting the kind of response he got in Europe or even in Turkey. It's going to be a much more guarded, not an emotion-filled reception. And that's Andres Martinez, who's director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Fellows Program for the New American Foundation, talking about the Summit of the Americas taking place in Trinidad and Tobago, and Barack Obama is there. We are also talking about teachers. Do you remember that one teacher or one affirming conversation that helped lead to your success? You can learn about one particular method that helps black students, especially in middle school, by going to our website, thetakeaway.org. It's an interesting scientific study we talked about earlier on the program. We all know words that can have an impact and that can last a lifetime, so we want to hear from you what moments and conversations that worked and didn't work for your future success. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Working with you, Richard, has been truly...
It's been great. It's been fun.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Yesterday, 16 people were killed in a shootout between suspected drug traffickers and soldiers near Acapulco, Mexico. It was hours before Barack Obama arrived in Mexico to talk with the Mexican President Felipe Calderon about joint efforts of Mexicans and U.S. officials to fight the drug war going on along the border and really throughout the hemisphere. And Barack Obama says our part and our responsibility in that war is clear.
This war is being waged with guns purchased not here, but in the United States. More than 90% of the guns recovered in Mexico come from the United States, many from gun shops that line our shared border. So we have responsibilities as well. We have to do our part.
Barack Obama speaking at a news conference with Felipe Calderon, the president of Mexico, yesterday. Jim Pruitt, owner of Pruitt's Guns and Ammo in Houston, Texas, what's your part in helping to fight the drug war down in Mexico, do you think?
I think my part, of course, is to enforce the current laws that are in effect, and that basically whenever we sell a gun, they have to fill out a background check and have a federal background check performed. We do that on every gun sale, be it a rifle, shotgun, or a pistol. And, of course, and if there are anomalies, we call ATF.
All right, let's talk anomalies for a minute. Hi, my name is Francisco, Jim, and I'd like to buy about 70 or 80 high-powered rifles and have them shipped to me down in El Paso. Can I do that?
No, you can't do that.
Why?
Because I'm going to call the feds, and they're going to meet you in the parking lot.
Well, there's a Fed on the line right now, William McMahon, Deputy Assistant Director of Field Operations at the ATF. He joins us from Washington. William McMahon, is Jim Pruitt normal or typical of gun owners in Texas and places along the border?
He is. We work very closely with the industry. We regulate them, but then we also work with them and train them on what to look for of those anomalies that we're talking about.
All right, but anomalies. I mean, if 90% of the guns in the Mexican drug war, according to the president, come from the United States, I don't know if that's an anomaly. That feels like a tsunami. Jim Pruitt, I mean, somebody's misbehaving here.
Hold on a second. You got to question the source. There have been no serial numbers issued and, of course, no details. 90% of what? I'd like to know about that. Jim Pruitt's Guns and Ammo and all the gun dealers that I know in the Houston area do not supply guns to Mexico, because knowingly, of course. I mean, it could occur on a pistol or a rifle here and there. But, you know, this idea that just because it's stamped, made in America, that it's a gun that comes out of Houston or Texas. That's kind of interesting.
So, Jim, then how aggressively are you and your fellow law-abiding gun owners banding together to prevent the bad apples from making you guys look bad?
Well, I'll tell you exactly a reason. And, hey, Agent McMahon, we appreciate your service. My son is a sergeant in the police department of Austin, Texas. I don't want to be a store that sells a gun to a criminal piece of scum that ends up shooting my son. And, of course, we're always concerned in that. And I think most gun owners work closely with ATF. And because what do you want to do, risk your license for maybe a $100 profit on a
gun?
Well,
some people apparently are. William McMahon, how are gun owners who are or gun shop owners who are law-abiding banding together to keep the bad apples, so-called, from making everybody look bad?
Well, I think what we're doing, what's happening, is that there are some people out that are taking advantage of the system, and they're purchasing firearms and making that small profit, and they're putting these firearms in the hands of criminals that are using them to murder people in Mexico. And so I applaud the gun dealers like Jim that there are taking that extra step. There are a number of regulations that people have to do before they purchase a firearm, fill out a form, get a background check done. But the criminal element is tries to take advantage of that by getting people with clean backgrounds to come in and purchase one or two firearms and then secrete those to a trafficker who gets them down to Mexico.
Right, but Jim Pruitt, I mean, in the state of Texas, if I have a clean record and a driver's license and ask for, 150 or 1,000 rifles, under Texas law, you can sell those to me. Right?
Well, technically I could, but it would be the dumbest thing I'd ever do because I'd be out of business. I would also be less than patriotic, in helping to defend our country.
But then why not make that illegal? You know, why not?
Well, it should. There's no requirement. All we have to do is fill out the background check. But there also is a thing in the rules that the gun store owner, even after all the legal requirements are made, has the final decision to be made. And there are times when they've filled out the paper, it's all correct, they have all the documents, and we utter the statement, we'd be glad to sell you a gun, but we're not going to do it today.
Have you done that this year?
I did it yesterday.
You did it yesterday. William McMahon, finally, would it make sense to change some of these laws? You say that people are taking advantage, but what they're doing is absolutely illegal if they're going in with a driver's license and a clean record and buying a truckload of high-powered rifles.
Well, we're working with the laws that we currently have, and I think we are making an impact. Again, working with the industry and helping them understand what to look for and people that might be trying to take advantage of the system is a big step. And again, with all of there's 54,000 gun dealers across the country, work very closely with them. And then when we do our inspections, then we only find that less than 1% are in violation where we have to actually take their license away.
All right, so the guns are coming from where? Just help me out here. There's a lot of guns.
Yeah, no, there's no mention of the fact that 150,000, this is what I hear, there are 150,000 desertions in the Mexican military alone per year. And I would think, just with my imagination, that it would be a good idea if I was a peasant making 4 pesos a day or whatever you make, to get into the military, get a little rank, get access to a full automatic weapon versus a semi-automatic weapon.
Or you could go to Texas and get a pickup load of them without joining the Army at all. The question is, does the law help or hinder here in the U.S.? But we'll have to leave it there. Jim Pruitt, owner of Pruitt's Guns and Ammo, thanks so much for talking with us. And now the headlines from Richard Hague.
And John, the Justice Department has released memos detailing harsh interrogation techniques used by the CIA under the Bush administration. But President Obama says CIA officials probably will not be prosecuted. The documents were released after a bitter debate within the Obama administration. U.S. nuclear experts head back to China today after they were kicked out of North Korea while monitoring nuclear facilities there. North Korea quit disarmament talks and threatened to restart its reactor after the U.N. criticized the nation for launching a missile test earlier in the month. Lesson of the day, don't download music illegally. A Swedish court has convicted 4 men linked to the Pirate Bay file-sharing site of breaking copyright law and sentenced them to up to a year in prison each. Jonathan Zuck is the president of the Association for Competitive Technology.
I think this is one of those issues that's just become overcomplicated. I think in reality, if you're stealing people's music, that there has to be consequences to doing it.
The men also have to pay $3.6 million to entertainment companies like Warner Brothers and Columbia Pictures. And also, Citibank posted its best earnings report since 2007 today, but they still lost money. Citibank has been one of the weakest of the big banks, posting losses since the end of 2007.
Why do they call it an earnings report then? Thank you, Richard.
Welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Morning, everyone. So, like, later on, I'm going to be getting to the mall, you know? Okay, you want to come?
Let's go to the mall, everybody! Everybody, come and play. Yeah. Throw every last care away. Let's go to the mall.
How I Met Your Mother, a bit of nostalgia there. Well, actually, nostalgia may be the point here. General Growth Properties yesterday, one of the biggest mall operators in the United States, filed for bankruptcy. It's a consequence of the terrible environment economically in the retail sector, but there's more going on here. We are seeing more and more malls die out. In fact, as our next guest wrote in the New York Times earlier this month, no new malls have been built in the United States since 2006. Joining us now from Atlanta is Ellen Dunham Jones. She's director of the Architecture Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Ellen, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You know, malls proliferated because of some big sociological changes in the United States, moves to the suburbs, growth in the suburbs, the car culture in the United States, even the proliferation of air conditioning technology allowed malls to exist and actually become a kind of icon of America. What's changed?
Well, a lot has changed. For one thing, the demographics in suburbia is undergoing a pretty major shift. We've seen a lot of suburban office growth, and that's drawn more and more young professionals to work in suburbia who have not yet started families. And we've still been building a lot of retail in the suburbs, but it's increasingly been open-air lifestyle centers or town centers that cater much more to an adult population than the teens who really are the lifeblood of malls and who sort of the voices in the intro music that we heard.
And, you know, many of those teens are probably online being sort of virtual mall rats rather than hanging out literally in the spaces, right?
There's an aspect of that. Certainly the internet has nipped into sales, although I really don't think that's the big factor. I think we're also seeing that malls really have, to a certain sense, been built out. The malls that are really thriving are those that are located at major highway exits. And the earlier generation of malls that were built at sort of suburban arterial locations just aren't getting the traffic, and we haven't been building that many new highways to really sort of fuel more new mall growth.
Now, gas prices, of course, are down. Is transportation and the cost of getting to the mall and the requirement that you use your car a consideration that over the long term makes malls not only a bad business idea, but really almost irrelevant to the way we're going to be living in the future?
I certainly think so in the long term. I don't know that we can't prove that that's actually really been happening yet. But the trend has been for a lot of older malls to be redeveloped as mixed-use town centers where with public streets and retail at the ground level and people living and working above the mall shops. And it's really providing a lot of suburbs with downtowns that they didn't used to have really revitalizing them and speaking to the new demographics where a lot of people want to live a more urban, more convenient lifestyle that is less car dependent, even though it's in a more or less suburban location.
Well, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but you are director of the architecture program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. What's an example of a really creative reuse, repurposing of a mall space, which is what, a couple of boxes and a big parking lot, right?
Yeah, well, there have been all sorts of amazing reuses. I mean, really almost anything you can name has at some point or another found its way into a mall. We've seen them turned into nursing homes, into community colleges. We've seen them become artist spaces. But we've also seen many malls be largely demolished, often the department stores because those are multi-story and they can easily be adaptively reused. But we've often seen all of the inline stores be demolished and then replaced with real open-air streets and higher density living.
So they literally dig up the parking lot and create a network of streets and then put smaller buildings along them and maybe preserve some of the big boxes as kind of central downtown-y sorts of buildings. But it's kind of like a Disneyfication.
There are people that, especially a lot of architects, really often sort of decry this as instant urbanism and somewhat faux and false. But I think when you look at many of the neighborhoods in New York, really were actually built over a pretty short period of time. The neighborhoods like Morningside Heights were really built out in about 15 years. And they were the instant urbanism of their day, but they've now grown into beloved neighborhoods. I think places like Bel Mar is a really great suburban retrofit just outside of Denver, or the Cottonwood Mall that was planned as one of General Growth's major retrofits outside of Salt Lake City, are examples of projects that in time will lose that instant kind of patina. It's more, what's really important is getting that urban structure that allows us to not have to rely on our cars.
Finally, in this mission of repurposing, how is the question of urban planning and sprawl addressed best, do you think, before we go? And we just have about a minute.
What's really interesting is we're starting to see much more nodal development. So instead of just a single core downtown and then endless suburbs, we're getting more urban pockets throughout the larger metro area. And that reduces overall trip lengths and does help to start to retrofit sprawl itself.
That's my takeaway. Nodal, what did you call it? Nodal development?
Polycentric nodes,
polycentric.
If you want a really geeky term.
Ooh, that's great. Polycentric nodes. Yes, you learned it here first on The Takeaway. Ellen Dunham-Jones, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
My guest, Ellen Dunham-Jones, is the director of the architecture program at the Georgia Institute of Technology, talking about malls. It turns out if we make it out of this economic difficulty, there might just be a positive future for all those malls out there. Richard Haake, let's go to the mall or get some headlines anyway.
How about we'll go to Cuba, because Cuban leader Raul Castro says he's ready to talk with the U.S. about anything, and that includes human rights, freedom of the press, and political prisoners. Castro said, quote, "We could be wrong. We could admit it. We're human beings." International donors pledged $5 billion to Pakistan today to support its economy and fight off Islamic extremism. The U.S. and Japan each pledged $1 billion in aid. Okay, get ready for this one. An Australian airliner had to be grounded and evacuated after four baby pythons escaped from their container and then couldn't be found.
Get out.
That sounds familiar, right?
Enough is enough! I have had it with these snakes on this plane!
So there you go, Samuel
L.
Jackson.
The pythons got the idea from Samuel Jackson?
There you go. Apparently the snakes were just 6 inches long, and the plane was even fumigated. They still haven't found them yet.
So why didn't the pilot just say, these pythons are just 6 inches long, please ignore them, everything will be
That's
fine.
That's a great Australian accent you
right,
do.
Yes, sorry. So snakes on a plane for real?
For real, yeah.
All right, thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And Scott Clark from WWSP in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Got a question for you, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, put on your thinking cap here.
Okay.
All right, name a president from Arkansas famous for not having sex.
I was going to say Bill Clinton, the only one I can think of.
Bill Clinton, you got it, dude. What is trivial in this day and age? Well, Scott Clark should know. He's the promotions director of the largest trivia contest, which gets started tonight. He's a junior at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Scott Clark, in the age of this recession and where what is trivial seems to be becoming meaningful, if you're talking about pirates or if you're talking about Bill Clinton, used to be a huge world leader, now he seems to be the answer to a trivia question. How do you do a trivia contest in this day and age? And are you excited about tonight?
I am so excited. It was so hard to sleep last night. It's that exciting. You know what? This is a weekend that's just filled with happiness and upbeat, and there's no cares with anything else that's going on in the world. This is 54 hours of just trying to answer the most ridiculous questions. So,
and this has been done every year since 1969?
Correct. This is the 40th year of trivia and the 40th year of 90FM.
Of 90FM, that's the station there at University WWSP. Of Wisconsin, Stevens Point.
Yes.
Now, teams from all over the world are going to compete. Does that mean they come to Stevens Point?
Well, most people do play in Stevens Point. That means they're raiding people's basements and hotels, because we do have some questions that you need to be in Stevens Point in order to answer. But we do have a lot of people from the area who still play that can get this signal through radio. But we also have teams who can play online.
Radio. What is radio? There's a trivia question.
Yeah.
In the internet age. All right. Give me some questions here that sort of typify the hardcore trivia addict who competes at this tournament.
Ooh, okay. Well, a question I remember last year it had to do with this NFL superstar. During his high school years, he scored an average of 24 three-point shots a game. And according to his publicist, his ringtone was Walk the Line.
Now, this is NBA, right? Not NFL, right?
This is an NFL player.
A football player who scored three-point basketball shots and had a ringtone Walk the Line?
Yes.
Oh, man, that's good.
It's easy. Tony Romo.
Nice. That's good. Are a lot of them on sports, or do you get into government stuff? Or, I mean, you can do internet kind of, video game stuff these days too, right?
Well, that's the thing. The trivia coordinator, Jim Oliva, or the Oz, when he writes the questions, it's on about anything. It's about movies, TV, current events, sports, for example, you know, video games. The sky's the limit. It's just more like, it's not hard facts. It's just more like random stuff.
Okay, quickly, who played the Doctor in the original Star Trek?
Oh,
dude, come on.
I don't know that.
10 seconds. DeForest Kelly, Scott Clark, a.k.a. DJ Albino, on WWSP, promotions director for the largest trivia contest in the world. Get started tonight. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, we conclude our Color of Money series right after headlines from Richard Hake.
And John, the Justice Department has released memos detailing the brutal interrogation techniques used by the CIA under the Bush administration. Although President Obama said that officials implicated in the memos will not be prosecuted, he did not rule out the possibility that higher-level administration officials could face prosecution. U.S. nuclear experts head back to China today after they were kicked out of North Korea while monitoring nuclear facilities there. North Korea quit disarmament talks and threatened to restart its reactor after the UN criticized the nation for launching a missile test earlier this month. The Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, is condemning those who smuggled illegal immigrants.
Evil smugglers are engaged in the world's most evil trade, and they should all rot in jail because they represent the absolute scum of the earth.
Pretty strong words. This after a small fishing boat carrying 47 asylum seekers exploded there yesterday. Three people were killed in that incident.
Oh, thanks, Richard.
You're welcome.
Once again, the theme of our series all week long, The Color of Money, that's Mo Money, Mo Problems, the Grammy-nominated album from the Notorious B.I.G., Life After Death. It's the theme of a look that we are taking at the economic changes taking place in the U.S. economy and how it is affecting disparities that already exist between racial groups, people of color, communities of color, and things like health care, unemployment, layoffs. Joining us to kind of lay out some of the themes that we've explored this week and take a look back is Sudhir Venkatesh. He's the William B. Ransford Professor of Sociology at Columbia University, author of Gang Leader for a Day and Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. He's right here in our studio. Sudhir, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
You know, the color of money was an idea that we had to explore some of the sociological trends that may be either accelerated or decelerated by the recession. What are the themes as you've seen them?
Well, in the shows that you've aired, they've been fascinating, and I think what they point to is that the low-income population in the U.S. really is in a different economy entirely, different kinds of currency, different kinds of social supports, different kinds of regulation, different kinds of adjustments that they have to make. And I think that's hard for many of us to see. Last night I called a bodega store owner on 106th, and I asked him this question because I knew he was going to get rid of his cash register. A bodega store owner in a poor neighborhood, he says about 40 to 50% of his transactions are in cash. So he gets food stamps, he gets promises of labor, and he sells those promises of labor. It's tough for most of us to think about an economy like that, but that's what poor people are living in, because something totally different.
He's down to 40% cash transactions. Everything else is barter or government-issued paper of some kind that's not money.
That's right. I want a can of soup. I come in there, and I promise to paint a house for 5 hours. He takes my promise of 5 hours of paint, and he sells it to someone else, and that person goes on and on and on. What you see is that people get wrapped up in a whole different world that's outside the mainstream economy that's really very different than what middle class people live in.
Now, you know, some people often like to describe phenomena like these as sort of the entrepreneurial spirit and the example of the creativity of communities under economic stress. But I'm wondering if this is isn't a form of a response to desperation, and that we should be alarmed by this, not admiring of the cleverness.
That's right. You always want to some degree admire the creativity. The problem in today's age is that, as your shows have shown, poor people are just getting farther and farther from mainstream institutions. They're not going to banks, they're going to loan sharks. When they're in debt, they're going to prison. They're not able to call friends for help. That's the troubling sign, is that in tough economic times, low-income people get marginalized even more than they already are, and it takes even more to bring them back.
All right, let's talk about the bring them back for a moment. You are suggesting that the worlds are already pretty separate, that the recession accelerates a kind of total break, but that the attempt to use government means to reverse the economic trends is almost impossible or limited because the disconnection means the government can't reach them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's really big. Here's an example. There are a lot of firms in New York that might hire a janitor to clean their offices. And right when the recession starts to hit, they won't really lay them off. They'll be paying them $20 an hour. They'll hire them back at $7 an hour under the table. So what happens? Is that person outside the economy or inside the economy? He's cleaning the same office. So it's a weird kind of place where people are both marginal and they're still functioning in the economy.
You know, when the economy changed significantly in the 1970s, the economists began to note that there was this group of people called the discouraged workers who you couldn't measure anymore, who were actually unemployed, but they'd just given up on the economy. And so the unemployment rate changed. It used to be a measure of people who were out of work. Now, only the people who want to get work are measured in the official unemployment rate by the Department of Labor. But this so-called discouraged workers is a kind of a leftover sociological indicator of something that happened back in the 1970s. What are we going to be measuring, 20 years from now that reflects these trends that you're talking about, do you think?
Yeah, you really have to almost double and in some cases triple what we people call the unemployment rate to really find out the number of people that have given up work, that are no longer even interested in looking at work and totally out of the labor force. I think another trend that we're going to see is the rise in subcontracting, that people don't get unionized jobs with all of these supports. They go in and they work at will. They may work for a particular job and then get laid off. They may come back if there's work available. That's really hard to track, because those people aren't reporting their work in the same way. But it's a different kind of labor arrangement. And the key for government is, what are the kinds of supports that someone needs for 5 weeks between jobs? How do you get them the stability that they need to be able to pay their bills and so on and get back on their feet, get reskilled?
Are we talking about a racial divide here or just a class divide here?
I would say in the last 20 years, it's a little bit more class. I mean, certainly disproportionately minorities face these kinds of problems of moving in and out of the labor force with no social supports. But it really is a low-income problem where you have whites and Asians and African-Americans and so on. We are really at a different age today.
If you're in this recession and are facing some of the problems that you've described here, is your ability as a black worker, a Hispanic worker, or a white worker better or worse able to get out of this on your own?
If you are a minority in this country and you're trying to get up from a job loss or trying to get into the economy again, you're always facing a tougher time. And the key to actually trying to do something for those groups is to work at a community level, to saturate the community in a sort of a WPA style with financial literacy, promote savings, get jobs locally, because people only get jobs through networks. And if everyone in your social network can't find a job, then you're sort of trapped not only by your own inability to find a job, but also by everyone else around
you. So a federal stimulus package that addressed that kind of community-based infrastructure, you know, that would work. But that's not what we're doing.
No, and we have an example in land trusts, for example. We put land in a trust for the public good. We could have community economic trusts where all of the resources for a particular period of time stay locally and help everyone locally. That's the kind of innovative work that microfinancers, for example, use that we need to borrow.
You know, I don't know about you, but the most disturbing fact for me before we go in all the stuff we talked about this week was the healthcare disparity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the emergency room is basically the healthcare system for the urban poor. It's an awful place to be. And healthcare and housing are really the things that people feel the worst in the economy right away.
And those are getting worse, particularly the emergency rooms.
Those are getting much worse. Absolutely. And emergency rooms are just getting flooded.
So is there a policy prescription aside from the community-based trust idea that we should send off to our listeners as a takeaway this week?
You know, now we go back to the social contract. What is the social contract that keeps us together? It used to be the marketplace for 100 years. Now we have to reinvent what it is that actually keeps American society together. We have to think of a new bond that makes America a collective unit.
Obama talks the talk. Do you think it's likely to happen in this administration?
I think so, but I really think it's about getting rid of the kind of demons that haunt us when we hear words like collective, socialist, distribution, these sorts of things.
Big government bad.
Big government is bad. We have to find new language that brings us together, and it's a good start.
Well, a good start, a good finish, too. Sudhir Venkatesh is the William B. Ransford Professor of Sociology at Columbia University and author of all kinds of books, including Gang Leader for a Day and Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor, helping us to look back at our series we called The Color of Money, Disparities in Experiencing This Recession. Thanks so much to you and to all of you who responded. We're hearing your stories about teachers and other people who have supported you and changed your life. One of you told us this story. When I was a little kid, I was supposed to wait for my bus at the schoolyard. But when the bus was called, it took me a couple of times to figure out which one to take. The teacher who was in charge of the schoolyard called me over and asked me what the rule was for getting on buses. I said, I didn't know. And he told me the rules were there to be obeyed, not to be discussed. From then on, that served me quite well through my life. What changed your life or scarred you for life? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. The Takeaway?
What you're looking at here is a bureaucratization of cruelty. It is this very sort of question of how many angels can dance on the head of the pin, what's pain, what's severe pain. It's a very weird combination of something that seems very modern and other things that seem medieval.
That's Jane Mayer on the torture memos. You can find out more at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Huckenberry. Have a great weekend, won't you? This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.